College football season is set to open, and on campuses across the country, athletic departments continue to struggle to fill seats. Our college's writer Michael Smith is in to talk about big changes meant to address that at, of all places, Texas. Then we'll bring in NFL writer Ben Fisher to talk about a host of changes we'll see in stadiums across that league this year. And we'll close with executive editor and publisher Abe Madcore and what he's watching in the week ahead. All that and whatever else comes up once we get talking here in the newsroom of Sports Business Journal. I'm Bill King, and this is First Look. Bevo Boulevard, Longhorn City Limits, Smokies Midway. No, you have not wandered into a Texas-themed Six Flags amusement park. All three of those are components of the action going on outside the stadium at a Texas football game. You wouldn't think they need more than football to fill the seats for a home game at the University of Texas. It's Texas, but it seems like they do. Our college's writer Michael Smith is here to share that story this week. Michael, average attendance for football at FBS schools fell for the seventh time in 8 years last year, dropping to 41,856, its lowest point in 22 years. Before we get to what's going on at Texas, let's look at the overall issue. What's going on at campuses across the country?
You know, Bill, when I think about the fan experience at college football games, I think of community, I think of reunion, I think of college buddies getting together, I think of tailgating. And if you have that kind of setup, sometimes that can be enough. At Texas, they felt like it wasn't enough and that they wanted to do more. I think you get different experiences at different games, and that's part of what makes college football so appealing. But I think when you get lazy and maybe you just count on tailgating to be what brings people to the game, I think that may be the case at some schools.
We're looking at a lot of empty seats, though, right? And at good programs, big programs.
Right, and that's why a lot of stadium renovations are taking seats out to try to make the seats nicer, bigger, more premium, more access to food and beverage, those sorts of things to try to improve the fan experience, again, inside the stadium. But outside the stadium is really where Texas has been focused. And one of the projections for the Texas-LSU game on September 7th, which is one of the most anticipated games of the season.
I'm looking forward to it.
There's probably going to be 150,000 people there, you know, maybe 100,000 inside the stadium and 50,000 or so outside the stadium. And that's because of all the new entertainment options that Texas is offering that makes regular season game day feel like a CFP championship outside the stadium.
So tell me a little more about that. I mean, Longhorn City Limits, Bevo Boulevard, Smokies Midway. What are these things?
Bevo Boulevard is like just a supercharged fan fest type of setting. The Longhorn City Limits is a concert series where they have acts like Aloe Black was one from last season.
Tip of the cap to Austin City Limits, of course.
Exactly. Which I didn't know this until I started researching the story that the University of Texas has the rights to use the city limits. And that's why they didn't have to jump through any hoops to name it Longhorn City Limits. And then Smokies Midway will be new this year, and it's kind of like a take on the Texas State Fair, bringing in the interactives, the games, the prizes, the pop-up characters all throughout that space. And so right next to Smokies Midway also will be a new Hall of Fame, close to 30,000 square feet. Believe it or not, Texas didn't have a place to display all their trophies and memorabilia, and this is another area that will attract fans.
So this all started, I would suspect, with a change in the athletic director's office, right? Chris Del Conde comes in. Tell me about that and how he and his vision figure into all of this.
Right. So he's just 6 months into the job last year when he and his staff start talking about total makeover of the tailgating pregame experience on game day.
Based on why? I mean,
well, based on one primary factor is that there's a real lack of tailgating, you know, traditional tailgating space. Because it's so built up around the stadium.
Bunch of parking garages, let me guess.
Right, right. And that's not a great tailgating experience typically is to, you know, tailgate in the garage. He started thinking about, you know, what can we do to improve game day and to improve the fan experience and to create something on par with what the Texas brand is. In Del Conte's mind, that when they go about doing something new like this, the expectation is that it's Texas and it should be the best. And so they come up with the concert and the fan fest. And, you know, the cool thing about Bevo Boulevard is I don't know that there's necessarily anything in the fan fest that in and of itself is new or that different. It's just that the way that they brought it all together so that all the fan activities are in one place, and it gives fans a chance to see the band, see the cheerleaders, see the team walk through, see the mascot, all in one area. That's been a good approach for them that worked last year, and they continue to work this year.
And a lot of changes had to go with this, right? So game presentation required some changes. Creating that space, I suspect there were probably donors that had to be, I believe you wrote that, right? Donors that had to be moved out. Tell me a little bit about that and sort of how they had to break from what they were already doing in order to incorporate all this stuff, that it wasn't as simple as just saying, hey, yeah, we'll just take this street and do this and this street and do that, and then we'll border it here and we're good.
Bill, I think it's almost more fascinating what they did inside the stadium than outside the stadium, because inside the stadium, they wanted to totally remake the script for a game and what the entertainment looked and felt like. And to do that, they had to move the sponsors, the dozen or so sponsors inside the stadium, outside the stadium, to create more of a clean venue so that when they're doing their in-between quarter entertainment or their videos on the LED board, they're all geared toward getting the fans hyped up and getting the team hyped up. And so it's high energy. You don't have one of those situations where you score a touchdown and during the next timeout, you bring the geology professor out for some award that he won that you've never heard of. And he's got to talk donors into moving out of their best parking spots. And he's got to talk to sponsors into getting out of the stadium and creating a new space for the sponsors in Bevo Boulevard. Those are some tough things to do for a first-year AD, but I think it shows the credibility that Del Conte came with and the respect that he's earned at Texas in his second season now.
For people who don't follow college that closely, his background.
He's a longtime administrator, came up through the ranks at places like Cal Poly in Arizona, became the AD at Rice mm-hmm. and TCU. And TCU really is where he became right. more of a national name, highly, highly respected for his ideas and his leadership style. He has a unique way of getting people to do more than what they thought they were capable of. And so he's a lot of fun. One of the things I'm going to do for the Texas LSU game is shadow Del Conte over the course of that game day, which should be an absolute blast and something I'm really looking forward to.
You wrote about his philosophy on R&D. Share that.
Right.
I love that.
So R&D, as you know, is research and development. But in Del Conte's world, it's rip off and duplicate. And he doesn't hide the fact that he'll take somebody else's idea and institute it himself in order to make his fan experience or whatever the case may be better. So we went back and looked at fan fests that he had been associated with at Cal Poly in Arizona and other inspirations for the Bevo Boulevard, like the Texas State Fair and the Austin City Limits.
Yeah, and the Smokies Midway, right? That was another one from the Texas State Fair. He that was one of the first things he did, right? He went to the Texas State Fair and walked it and had somebody taking pictures. And what was that all about?
Which is crazy for an AD who had been at Rice and been at TCU. He'd never been to the Texas State Fair. So he goes to the fair for the first time last year before the Texas-Oklahoma game, which is at the fairgrounds. Just checks out all the different fan experiences at the State Fair, and so he wants to bring this back to Austin to incorporate into his game day. And so that's what they're calling the Smokies Midway. It's a miniature Texas State Fair, seven times a year right there on next to the stadium on game day.
Texas had a great football season last year. I mean, for the first time in a while, they were relevant again. And so you would expect that there would be an uptick. So it's probably hard to parse out, is the uptick, hey, we're doing well on the field again, or is the uptick, people really love this experience around it? What do you think?
Well, that's a great question. It's always, is it because they're winning or is it because it's great marketing and that sort of thing? One thing I would point to is that Texas went out and lost their opening game to Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're coming back week two for their first home game and the first Bevo Boulevard. So there's a lot of tension and anxiety around Texas athletics on whether or not the loss to Maryland in the opener last year would impact the crowd.
Because it did start to look like the same old, same old.
Right. Turns out that roughly 30,000 people showed up for Bevo Boulevard for the concert. And so that eased a lot of tension that even though they came into that game 0-1, that a good crowd still showed up And that was kind of a reinforcement in their mind that they were doing the right thing.
If Texas can look at this and say, you know what we've been doing for 100 years and just saying, hey, we're Texas, isn't enough anymore. Is that an approach that you think we're going to see roll out more and more across college football? Because again, you know, I'm a Gator. I went to Florida and I was shocked to go to a home game last year and see tons of empty seats for a game against South Carolina in an SEC game. Lots and lots of empty seats just because they had gotten beat the week before. But it was a decent season. Not great, but decent. And that was an eye-opener for me. But we've talked about it. It's that they're not alone. This is going on all over the country, right?
Well, in bits and pieces. You know, you've got schools like Florida State that's been doing a Friday night concert. You've got schools like Oregon State that are really creating, you know, neat beer garden areas and places to get unique food and drink options. You can find examples of bits and pieces of it all across the country, but nobody has really brought it all together like Texas has to, you know, like we say in the story, reimagine what game day can be, especially in terms of bringing in fans who may not be going to the game, who just want to come experience, mm-hmm. you know, seeing the team walk by and see the mascot. And, you know, maybe they have little children and they can't do it all day, but they want to come in and get that piece of it.
Well, my theory all along has been that this is just all reflective of the collapse of the season ticket, right? I mean, you no longer need a season ticket in college football. StubHub and ticket resale just absolutely changed the world. And so if you don't have a season ticket, you know, maybe you're not going to a lot of these second tier games. I think that's what is behind a lot of this. Do you think that moves towards solving that?
When you look at the trends, there are certainly more people that are buying tickets on the day of the game. There are more people who are buying tickets on mobile. Mobile makes it easier to go onto StubHub and buy a ticket the day of the game. Of course, what you lose is that per-seat donation. You lose that potential member for the booster club. From the way that Texas was looking at it, they want people to come, whether they have a ticket or not, experience game day, and then maybe they buy a ticket or become a donor down the road. In some ways, it's like an investment. But, you know, I wouldn't say that this is the right thing for every school to do. Not every school had the challenges that Texas had. You know, I think of Clemson, for example. They have tremendous tailgating areas to the point when they consider making changes, they typically come back and say, you know, let's not fix what's not broken.
Right.
I think it depends on the school and it depends on what their culture is and kind of the institutional approach to things. But I do think that there are ways in which improving game day and improving the fan experience can get more people onto campus, and maybe it does lead to a little bit more business down the road.
So this story's about part of an overall season kickoff package. What else are you watching as this season kicks off?
Well, you know, like we talked about, certainly attendance, ticket buying trends. We've been writing about that quite a bit already. And this week we'll launch the ACC network. We'll see ESPN and the ACC launch their new network. They got a big distribution deal done with Charter Spectrum, which is incredibly vital because that covers Tobacco Road. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine launching an ACC network.
Yeah, that wouldn't work.
If nobody on Tobacco Road could see it.
That's all right. It reminds me of years ago when Florida moved a bunch of its programming to an upstart called Sports Channel Florida, which was available in about 80% of the state of Florida. Not available in Gainesville, however. Yeah. That didn't go well.
Well, and especially when you think about the ACC network coming out with a lot of unique programming that's going to be geared toward basketball. Mm-hmm. There's a Duke documentary. There's a UNC basketball documentary. Certainly, you want the fans along Tobacco Road to be able to take all that in. In addition to that, Louisville football is going to have a kind of an all-access type of show come out on the ACC network, and Charter Spectrum covers Kentucky. So really a big win for ESPN and the ACC network on that deal. It'll be interesting to see as we lead up to the first football game on the 29th, Georgia Tech at Clemson, if this could maybe spur some additional activity and maybe another one or two more distribution deals down the road.
ACC plays football still, do they?
They do.
They do.
You've heard of Clemson.
Yeah. Right? I'm familiar with Clemson. They're in the SEC, aren't they?
They play like
I've been arguing for years they should be in the SEC.
They play like an SEC team for sure.
All right. Michael, great stuff. Thanks so much. Looking forward to talking to you throughout the season.
Awesome, Bill. Thanks.
Now we'll go from the fan experience at and outside college games to a similar discussion about changes in stadiums around the NFL heading into this season. For that, we bring in our NFL writer, Ben Fisher, who has that story this week. Ben, let's talk about some of the more interesting movement you found around the league. What caught your eye, and is there a theme that ties a lot of that together?
Well, I think the theme is that they don't necessarily need to be major investments. That as the league looks around at what can be improved, you know, there's a lot to like, and there might be, you know, $100 million renovation that can make fans' life a little more pleasant, but there could be relatively minor things too that all add up to a better experience of the games. And you know, we've seen, you know, we've got some fairly significant projects going on, like in Miami, where they're building pedestrian tunnels and overpasses.
Right.
So pedestrians and cars are no longer competing for the same real estate as they're leaving the game.
Getting out of that place can be difficult.
Yes, exactly. And we'll circle back to that same topic up in Foxborough. The Patriots are doing something interesting too. But then, you know, other places like 49ers in Santa Clara, Levi's Stadium, are building a little supporters club area that are going to relocate some fans who already hold tickets who are part of their affinity groups into some higher level seating in the lower bowl. And they'll do some special programming around there. And, you know, their sense is, you know, it's not that they're losing these fans, but, you know, make it more likely that they continue to choose the stadium over the couch in the coming years.
Is that you use the word supporters? That's a football like the other football thing, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, the NFL, at least a few clubs in the NFL are recognizing that while they certainly love the business of the NFL, that MLS has something
right.
Something to tell them about how to run the game day experience, and getting fans more involved in the game in the way that you'd see at a soccer match is not a bad thought.
The anecdote you had about what's gone on with Pepsi at MetLife Stadium when they did their contract tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, right. Thanks for reminding me. I think that was probably the most interesting thing I learned in this whole story. I didn't lead with it, so I better...
You led with it in the story. That's all that matters.
Well, no, 2 years ago when Pepsi renewed with MetLife to be their porter, part of their fee is going to a capital expenditure fund. So Pepsi is funding and is at the table in deciding how this is going to be built. They're going to literally rebuild the physical structure of food and beverage at MetLife Stadium, thinking that every time you walk into a sporting event that has any half-decent crowd, it's always a really unappealing line to get basic food.
That's
they
right.
Think by rebuilding the whole operation, they can fix that, or at least find some workaround so fans don't have to choose between missing the game and getting a meal. A couple of their ideas there at MetLife are, you know, convenience stores-style operations where there's prepackaged food. If
right.
You know, the airport equivalent, when you don't have time for a sit-down, you just grab a sandwich and go, and I think that's got a lot of promise. And
I've seen that in some arenas, actually, some NBA arenas, NBA, NHL arenas.
Right. That's not exactly a brand new idea, but, you know, always if you're talking NFL
right.
And the 70,000, 80,000 seat stadium, then you know, that's at a different scale.
There's this trend, it seems, to trying to move people from, whether it's through a concession line or in or out of the stadium more efficiently, more quickly. The Jets are doing something there, right? And so are the Patriots?
Yeah, let's go up to New England and talk about that for a second. Last year, they had a pilot program that was very unofficial. They didn't talk about it much, but they got some good results of it, where they give you free parking if you agree not to leave before 75 minutes after the end of the game. And
that's a pretty good deal.
Sort of flexible. Yeah, well, right. I mean, if you're not too concerned about your timing, that's a pretty nice little deal. And last year, they just opened up a separate parking lot for it and sort of put out a call before games and just wanted to see, you had to pre-register for it to see how much interest there was. And it was, you know, quite a nice little crowd, enough that they're sort of making this more of a formal program this year. And they think if they can even take like 1,000 cars off, Route 1 outside of Gillette, in the immediate aftermath of the game, that's going to make every fan's experience just a little bit better getting out of the stadium there.
I know that, you know, having spent a career as a sports writer, I remember the first time I started going to games and taking my family, and I walked out of a stadium and got in my car. I was used to leaving the game 3 hours after it was over. I was completely unaware of this phenomenon of sitting in your car for an hour. It amazed me that people did it, and I think we've moved on in our society to a point where people just aren't willing to do it.
Right, and it's an increasing problem. And look, you know, most NFL stadiums are full most days. But, you know, they understand that as exciting as the actual game aspect is, there's a lot of parts that aren't the game that are pretty unpleasant. And it's hard to compare to the comfort of your own couch. So, you know, you get people out 20 minutes faster. That could be part of the decision making on season ticket renewals. I joked with some folks in New England that, you know, it's easy to hang out afterwards after you win 85 or 90% of your home game. Let's wait for them to have a down year someday in the distant future.
That's right.
And they're losing by 3 touchdowns in the third quarter.
And people are actually trying to get out early. Yeah. Never mind, stay late.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Beating the traffic is not a phenomenon in New England.
Right.
So let's segue over a big week for the NFL, finally on the sports betting landscape with their first move. And really, there were some other moves that I want to talk about. But let's start with the NFL and a deal with Sport Radar, right?
Right. Monday morning, the NFL finally did an official data deal with Sport Radar. I think it looks basically like the deal, some other deals Sports Radar has done with other leagues.
Right.
It's important because it's the NFL, and it's the first time that the NFL is directly monetizing sports gambling. You know, I don't think it took anyone by surprise that this deal came to pass, but nevertheless, it's an important marker in this gradual but ongoing rollout of gambling in the United States.
It is, and the fact that they chose the exclusivity actually does make them a little bit different, and especially among the larger leagues. Interesting that they chose to go the exclusive route, and that is purely a financial decision. I mean, as much as the NFL might want to talk about how this is about consumer protection and delivering data and integrity and all those other things, I mean, the fact is when you choose to make the deal exclusive, you are by nature increasing the price of that data, most likely, and certainly increasing the price makes it less likely to be as widely distributed. So I think it's worth noting, a smart business decision probably, because they are going to maximize the revenue, I think. But I think they lose any argument that this is about getting that data out there to protect consumers. I think it's kind of specious at this point when you look at the fact that they went the exclusive route.
So your point is that if it really were about consumer protection, they would want as many people as
if it were really about consumer protection, they'd give the data away. But that's unreasonable. I don't think you could make a serious argument about that. You certainly could debate whether or not you're all that motivated that that's really the prime motivation when you choose to go exclusive, because the only reason to go exclusive is to increase the price.
Well, and one of the things that you and I uncovered in our story was how they are going to try to create contractual reasons for sports books to use the official data through the restrictions on sponsorships, which...
No, that's right.
Doesn't exactly shock me.
That's the same direction, and the NBA went the same direction that Major League Baseball went, and I think it's worked for both. It's taken a while, but you know they're both starting. MLB did a deal with FanDuel this week. They did a deal with DraftKings a couple of weeks ago. Talked to Kenny Gersh earlier this week at Major League Baseball. All indications he says that there's more deals in the pipeline, and they're going to come pretty quickly. So I think it's working. I think that as gambling rolls out in the States, you want to be in stadiums, you want to be in arenas, you want to have relationships that connect you to those fans to try and differentiate your product from all those other sports books that are out there. They're not necessarily similar now, but they're going to get there. You know, as it matures, it's going to product from one sports book to the next is probably going to look a lot more, much more similar. And so that relationship with the fan becomes more and more important. It makes all the sense in the world to require that data in order to do a team sponsorship. That is the data in and of itself probably isn't of value commensurate to what they want to charge. You don't absolutely need it to have a product, but it does make a better product. And it also, again, that access to the teams is crucial to the sports books. So all that, I think, figured into the way this week in sports betting came together.
Might have been a certain journalist temptation to characterize the Sports Radar deal as a tipping point where suddenly the pace of adoption, the pace of business activity in this world,
right,
the
right.
NFL, would dramatically increase. But, you know, talking around the league in the right. days after that announcement, still very much an emphasis on conservative, mm-hmm. You know, thoughtful expansion. We're not suddenly going to open up the sports book sponsorship category in like days or weeks. That's still on a long-term basis. And even though they got to this point with the data deal, still, you know, assume slower rather than faster when it comes to the NFL getting into this hurdle.
Really important point. I'm glad you made it, because I think a lot of people read it that way at the start of the week. And of course, we heard time and again over the week that that wasn't the case. So we're about ready to kick off a season. Ben Fisher, look forward to speaking with you about the NFL here on the podcast as we move along. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Bill.
And as we so often do to close the podcast, we'll now bring in our executive editor and publisher, Abe Madcore, to talk about what we're watching in the week ahead. Abe, what do you got?
I got five things I'm watching. What a crazy week and time in sports business, Bill. It's certainly not the quiet days of August.
No.
You and I are sitting here on a lovely Friday in Charlotte as we record this. Panthers open their home preseason.
Preseason. Oh, it's not an exhibition. No.
Preseason scheduled tonight
circus.
Against the Buffalo Bills. And what has fascinated me is all the efforts the Panthers have been doing to go entirely mobile ticketing. So it's impacting us, our friends, and the local market. Today's Friday's front page of the Charlotte Observer was a whole tutorial by the newspaper on Panthers mobile tickets. Here's how to get started. There was a line in there that people calling on Tuesday of this week had a recording that they may have to wait up to an hour to get instructions. The Panthers actually said that team officials dealt with most calls within 3 to 4 minutes. But it's an indication of just how difficult it is to make that transition for any organization from paper tickets to entirely mobile.
Even in a market that's had mobile ticketing now in its NBA franchise for how many years?
Not,
I mean, at least two or three. Not mobile only, but a lot of people use them. I mean, if you go through the gates, you see it mostly.
They do, but I'm going mobile only is a real, like, okay, in our office, we have company tickets, as you know, and everybody's having to be trained on how to transfer them, the email that comes, how to download them. And it's just fascinating to see this story. If you don't have an iPhone or a smartphone, any mobile device, what do you do?
Yeah, so then good
it's
luck.
A lot of effort. And I think tonight, if people go to that game, they better be prepared for a little bit of logistical issues. But I think any market, any team who is thinking about going all mobile should be paying attention to what the Panthers are doing. Second thing, I know you're aware of it too, Bill, and you and I have talked about it, just really keeping a close eye on the future of the Baltimore Orioles. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of buzz that I'm hearing. There's a lot of buzz in the media about the future of that franchise. We know that Peter Angelos is not in great health. We know his sons, John and Lou, are running the team. We know that that team really has never been the same since the Nationals went to Washington. And I will give you a lot of credit. You said years ago that the Nats were really going to impact the state of the Orioles, and they have. The team hasn't really played well at all. Also, ever since the riots in downtown Baltimore, the Inner Harbor of Baltimore has been a different place, and it's been hard to draw at night.
This is why Peter Angelos fought that team in Washington for years. He never said that that franchise couldn't succeed. He said two franchises couldn't succeed. And his concern, he was right, was that his would be the one that suffered. You know, that is two teams in one market. It just is really what it is. That's a two-team market.
But let's be fair. Well, what did he get out of that deal?
Oh, he got He got made whole. Yeah. I'm not saying he didn't get made whole. He made sure he got made whole.
And ownership of a
– Right, exactly. But the future was certainly impacted. Mm-hmm. It's still a great ballpark. It's still a great place to watch a game.
Yep.
I really believe they are just – you know what? Now they're like a lot of other markets is what they are. They're going to have to – they're going to have to do a lot of smart things in the community. They're going to have to market the heck out of things because you never want to lean on winning, right? So I think if they win, people come back. But you know, we've talked about this before. That's a cheap excuse, right? I mean, everybody thinks they can draw if they win. The key is real marketing is being able to draw when you don't win. And they got to figure out how to do that.
In the late 90s and early 2000s, they could just open the door.
That's right.
Yards.
That's right.
It was a full house.
That's
and
right.
When I worked there, it was still the place to be. But your point is a great one. When I lived in Washington, you had to go, 60 miles, whatever it is, 45 miles north to go to baseball games, and now you don't. So I'm keeping an eye on that. I do think, to your point, it's no longer like St. Louis where you just open the door and you're going to get $3 million. It is going to be a really tough – I think baseball is still viable in Baltimore.
I do, too.
To your point, the Angelos are still really doing fine with the ownership of the RSN, but it's a team to watch because there are some markets out there that would be appealing to them. Speaking of markets, I'm keeping an eye on St. Louis because apparently next week, MLS will announce St. Louis as the latest expansion market for that league. Interesting to me, I thought that St. Louis might suffer by the lack of corporate support, but apparently from the conversations I'm having, MLS loves the ownership group in that market, specifically that it's led by a large amount. It'd be really one of their first female-led mm-hmm. ownership groups, and I know that's important to MLS, and that would be Enterprise Holdings Foundation President Caroline Kendall Betts. So I was a little surprised, but at the end of the day, we'll have to see who gets that second team and third team. I still think it probably still lines up now for Sacramento, Charlotte, Charlotte, Sacramento. Mm-hmm. The reason MLS loves St. Louis, well, St. Louis is considered
St. Louis is the capital of U.S. soccer. Yeah. It is. It has been forever. It's always been a head scratcher that there hasn't been a team there.
Yeah, it'll be.
But obviously, I mean, we know the reasons: ownership group, facilities, mm-hmm, all the reasons mm-hmm. that you have in a lot of markets. But MLS has wanted to be in that market for as long as there's been MLS.
Not a depth of corporate support, but I think they'll make it work. And you can't end this week without talking about the future of the Nets. We had a really smart business executive in our office on Thursday, Bill, and I think you were part mm-hmm. of it. But, you know, ask that person, what's one franchise that intrigues you? Without pause, that person said, the Nets. I'm watching the Nets. And there's a lot of reasons. And with Joe Tsai taking over and a changing of the guard mm-hmm. there, and Brett Yormark likely leaving, Prokhorov likely leaving, it is, you see what they have done with the product on the court. You see what they want to do with Barclays. You see the other holdings that they want to basically leverage. The Nets could be a pretty interesting franchise, and it puts a lot of pressure on the Knicks. And I think that's a fascinating story in that market.
It absolutely is. It's always interesting, though, to be in New York, and I'm obviously a lot of our listeners live there. You know, the Knicks are still the Knicks, and the Garden is still the Garden.
Right.
And Brooklyn is still – it's funny because I just remember when they were building that arena and people said, look, it's a few subway stops. What's the big deal? Still a big deal when they're not attractive on the floor. They're attractive on the floor this year. And I do like, and I do find, I've been fascinated by the pieces they've put together around the arena and around the move they made in Long Island. And there's a lot of chess pieces there. Mm-hmm. And if you're the Garden, you better be awake.
Yeah. And I think that there are people who still say, like, Abe, you underestimate the vibe and the energy at the Garden for a Knicks game. And I probably do because I don't go to too many of them. But I still think, to your point, that team has to be really paying attention to what's happening in the other borough. I also am fascinated by the whole Jay-Z NFL
yes.
partnership. I was also fascinated by the controversy around Stephen Ross and how that impacts his Rise initiative, which I've come to know over the last 3 years. Pretty interesting initiative. Some heavy hitters on that board. And it's amazing how one quick decision, not a quick decision, but one decision about hosting a fundraiser in the Hamptons for President Trump can really put the future of that initiative in jeopardy. And I talked to a lot of people last week who weren't sure that this initiative could go forward. And they were working very hard to try to restore confidence of the players, the leagues who were part of this coalition, and to try to keep it going forward. And it was interesting that, you know, Robert Kraft really led the conversations between Jay-Z and Roger Goodell. He mm-hmm. got them introduced. Michael Rubin's part of that Meek Mill, that Reform Alliance. And then on the other hand, you have one other area of Rise potentially being disbanded if they can't keep the confidence of the players and the players don't believe that Ross is really behind this mission and really talks the talk. So you'll have to see how this unfolds. I know you and I talk politics and sports a lot. This is just the early stages of this campaign and this election, and it's going to get hot.
Were you shocked? I was shocked, honestly, of Ross's involvement in the fundraiser, of attaching himself to that.
I think a lot of people were surprised. The people I talked to told me that they tried hard to convince him not to do it. But if you've been around Stephen Ross or been around NFL owners,
they're right.
And even the conversations I had from the sources, he was very surprised. I'm just hosting a fundraiser. Like, what's the difference between what I'm doing and what Tom Brady has a Trump hat in his locker room, or Woody Johnson's the ambassador? What's the difference? And again, the people I talked to said the big difference is that, you know, you're out there hosting a fundraiser for his political reelection during a campaign season while you're also trying to lead an initiative about social justice, social reform, and racial equality. And at this time, they don't match. And he went ahead. And so there were a lot of angry colleagues, but they'll see if they can move on here and survive this. And I don't know if they're scrambling, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I would suspect it's going to get worse, to be honest with you. I just don't think it's going to, I don't think it's going to go away. I think it's going to come up again and again and again. And I think it's hard to move that initiative forward when you've got that kind of baggage.
We'll have to see. And as we said, it's hard to believe it's like mid-August because it doesn't feel like with things going on, you know, and what you and Ben talked about with the NFL and the NFL's, once the NFL starts, you know, all bets are off.
Because NFL starting, college football. We talked to Michael Smith, you know, college football ready to roll. Summer, dog days of summer are over.
Good stuff. Have a great week, man.
You too. That's going to do it for this week. So for Abe Madcore, Michael Smith, Ben Fisher, and our producer, Chris Mason, I'm Bill King, and this has been First Look.